It's the weekend, and the other side of the aisle never looks so far away. We start here. President Trump speaks to a divided nation and a visibly divided Congress.
I look at the Democrats in front of me, and I realize there is absolutely nothing I can say to make them happy.
One member had to be escorted out, and that wasn't the only contentious moment. With price hikes already taking effect, President Trump slams the brakes on car tariffs.
These car companies were making the case to the president that this would undermine their own competitiveness.
With all the back and forth, what does this mean for your wallet? And he promised no more fraud.
First, Fire 2 is real.
So why is the place supposedly hosting Firefest 2 saying it doesn't exist? From ABC News, this is Start Here Weekend. I'm Brad Milkey. Hello and welcome. Happy weekend. I'm Brad Milkey. I host ABC's daily podcast, Start Here, and we are so happy to bring you this weekend edition. Over the next hour, we're going to break down all the biggest stories of the week with the ABC News reporters who have had a front row seat to all these events. A lot of news to get to over the last week, so what are we waiting for? Let's go. The last time President Trump stood in front of Congress was early 2020. COVID was not even an acronym we understood yet. We were describing this novel coronavirus. The president had just been acquitted in his first impeachment trial. It would be nearly a year before his own supporters trashed that same building in the wake of his electoral defeat. Well, this week, Donald Trump walked into the Capitol triumphantly.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
With a Republican-controlled House and a Republican-controlled Senate, the Trump agenda has never had more support than it did right then. An agenda that has been enacted faster and more forcefully than many Trump allies even imagined. Of course, a big chunk of this room was still occupied by Democrats who are under pressure from their own constituents to do something, anything, to show some form of resistance. And it was that tension that made this, President Trump's first address to a joint session of Congress as the 47th president, so significant. This was a long speech, a real long speech. So let's get you caught up. ABC's White House correspondent Karen Travers was watching all of this play out. Karen, can you walk us through this?
Well, Brad, I'm going to say you stole my line because I had written down that it was a triumphant return because that's what Donald Trump looked like. You know, Donald Trump walking in with what he says is a robust election mandate, the will of the people at his back, and, you know, proudly strutting down that aisle to thunderous applause from one side of the room, the Republican side of the room.
Thank you.
It was striking, that beginning scene. And something he said early on, too, you know, made me kind of think about how he was looking at all of this.
The American dream is unstoppable, and our country is on the verge of a comeback, the likes of which the world has never witnessed and perhaps will never witness again.
He also talks about his own political comeback. So, you know, that, in his view, is complete. But, you know, for him now, it's like we bring the comeback to the country.
We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started.
His speech was talking about what he has done in just 43 days in office and what he wants to do now over the next 4 years. He made it very clear. This is a new sheriff in town. This is not the Biden administration anymore.
We won all seven swing states, giving us an electoral college victory of 300.
And it was also striking to hear him talk about his election victory in great detail, familiar grievances that we heard him do during those campaign rallies. But he did it in that setting, which is not normally what you see in a State of the Union address or an address to a joint session of Congress.
Yeah, and you mentioned thunderous applause from Republicans, standing ovation after standing ovation, and yet for nearly all of them, Democrats seated with their hands in their laps, right? There was this kind of lingering question about how loud or silent they would be. Where did they land here?
You know, I think people are going to remember not things the president said in the speech when you ask them about it in a couple of days or weeks. They're going to remember the optics in the room and what was clearly just a lack of decorum.
A 41-point jump.
You know, you had early on the Texas Congressman Al Green standing up and shouting at the president.
Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat.
shaking his cane at him and yelling that Trump had no mandate. This is when the president started talking about his election victory. And right there, that kind of sent things off the rails and set the tone for the rest of the night. He was escorted out of the House chamber. He spoke later to reporters and said that he felt that he had to do it.
So what were you shouting to the president?
The president said he had a mandate. And I was making it clear to the president that he has no mandate to cut Medicaid.
But it was one of the many protests we saw over the course of the night from Democrats who were holding up signs that said false. And you could see them scattered throughout their side of the room. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib had a whiteboard that she was changing her message on. And at one point said, that's a lie, when Trump was talking about different policy things that he would do or has done in some of his executive actions. So I think this may be the new normal for speeches in the second Trump era, that this set a tone of what maybe the next year's State of the Union will look like. Mm-hmm. Kind of all bets are off and the rules are all set aside. But the president also contributed to that because, you know, Brad, this was a pretty divisive speech.
Under Joe Biden, the worst president in American history, there were hundreds of thousands of illegal crossings a month.
He was not looking to reach across the aisle with policy ideas of bipartisanship or, you know, themes that Democrats would jump on.
And once again, I look at the Democrats in front of me and I realize there is absolutely nothing I can say to make them happy or to make them stand or smile or applaud. Nothing I can do.
Kind of went through a whole thing. I could find a cure to a devastating disease. I could have the best economic numbers and you still wouldn't cheer for me. Well, he also wasn't offering them anything like that over the course of the night. It was striking to me how there wasn't bipartisanship. There weren't any lines that got bipartisan moments. I mean, you see that even when, look, Washington's been divided for years. This is not something new.
I was going to say, like Obama or Trump won, right? Like you saw like bipartisan standing ovations.
Yeah.
Like America is great or whatever it is.
Exactly. There would always be something that you could begrudgingly get the other party on their feet. They don't like you, but they're going to stand up because they like this one thing you're talking about. Because maybe you put it in there just to force them to stand up. That didn't happen.
Right. And that really does end up being the tone of this speech, right, Karen? Like, you should join me, but this train is leaving the station with or without you. All right. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, Karen Travers is going to break down the actual policy shifts that this speech could yield. And there are several of them here. That's after the break. Welcome back to Start Here Weekend from ABC News. I'm Brad Milkey. Before we went to break, ABC's Karen Travers was describing President Trump's address to Congress. And Karen, you did say there were things Democrats were standing up for and applauding, just not many of them. What were they?
You know, the only two things you could point to were when the president was talking about Ukraine funding. You had Democrats standing up, but that wasn't something that was going to get the Republicans on their feet.
Do you want to keep it going for another 5 years? Yeah, you would say Pocahontas says yes.
And then there was the moment when the family of Corey Comprator was highlighted by the president. He, of course, was the man who was shot and killed at the president's rally in Butler, Pennsylvania last summer.
He threw himself on top of his wife and daughters and shielded them from the bullets with his own body.
And the president spoke at length about his bravery that day and what he meant to his family, his community. And, you know, the family seemed very emotional during all of that. But that was the rare, maybe the only time where there were a hefty number of Democrats on their feet. But, I mean, that's kind of notable that that's the only thing we could point to.
What was he sort of outlining? Was there any sort of news in how he was framing this that's different from every other day at the White House?
So it gave him a chance to say, here are all the things I've done over 43 days, which, you know, I could tell you because I've covered them for the last 43 days. But I think for Americans, it's been so much. There's just been this fire hose of news that you kind of can't keep track of everything.
The days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over.
But, you know, a lot of this is like kind of the easy things, like the low-hanging fruit of mm-hmm. what he wanted to come in. You know, he declared English is the official language. He changed the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Like, stuff like that that he can do. The hard stuff is coming, the legislation. I mean, look, there's a deadline coming up in 10 days for government funding to keep the government open. He also wants to get big, big things done in one big bill on energy policy, border security. And that is going to be the hard stuff.
April 2nd, reciprocal tariffs kick in. And whatever they tariff us, other countries, we will tariff them.
That's the one big thing that really stuck out to me is his comments on tariffs. He is not backing away from his reasoning for putting 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico and putting more tariffs on Chinese products coming into the U.S. That was his big announcement earlier this week. And there were no apologies from the president about that. I mean, he is very insistent that this is something that has to be done for fairness, that countries are ripping off the United States, but also it's a way for him to get those countries to do what he wants on things like migration and fentanyl. Now, economic experts will say there's going to be a cost to American consumers. You can't suddenly put 25% tariffs on vegetables coming from Mexico mm-hmm. and expect the importers to just absorb that cost. No, like your avocado is going to be more expensive and your tomatoes and other things that we're bringing in from those countries, two of our biggest trade partners, there's going to be an impact.
Our farmers starting on April 2nd, it may be a little bit of an adjustment period.
So to hear the president acknowledge that was really something.
There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that. It won't be much.
He doesn't want to call it pain. He doesn't want to call it price increases, but disturbance is certainly a notable acknowledgement that his policies right now toward Canada and Mexico especially are going to have an impact on Americans.
He's admitting, because you can't really have both, like, we're going to lower prices for everyone and we're going to slap on tariffs.
Right.
Saying, well, we might have some higher prices, but it's worth it in the long term, perhaps, for manufacturers that come here or something. You mentioned, like, overseas how Democrats were applauding sort of the plight of Ukrainians, mm-hmm. but there was also sort of news that was coming on the foreign policy front that we hadn't actually heard before.
And there was very little time spent, though, on the foreign policy topics in the speech. I mean, he got to that toward the end, and it was a very small percentage of the speech when you looked at the entire thing. He was much more focused on domestic policy.
And our country will be woke no longer.
You know, he spoke about wokeness, I think, more than he did about Ukraine or the Middle East. But he did say that he received an important letter, as he called it, from President Zelensky. And that in the letter, Zelensky told him Ukraine is ready to come to the negotiating table as soon as possible to bring lasting peace. And that Zelensky said his team is ready to work under President Trump's strong leadership to get a peace that lasts.
I appreciate that he sent this letter, just got it a little while ago.
We remember from last week the Oval Office explosive moment between the president and Zelensky and Vice President Vance jumping in there. White House officials have said that Zelensky should apologize to the president and that there were no way the negotiations were going to get back on track on peace or on a minerals deal unless Zelensky, groveled a bit and made up for what happened in the Oval. He didn't do that, but he did put out a statement that really appealed to Donald Trump, talking about how much he values what America's done. He referenced the president's strong leadership and said it's time to make things right. And you could tell the president was eager to tout that in the speech.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you also had Afghanistan, one of the terrorists, the alleged terrorists behind the explosion at Abbey Gate during the American withdrawal. Apparently, this was revealed during the speech, has been extradited to the U.S., so that was new. But Karen Travers, again, breaking down a long speech. Like, this was a record-setting speech, so I'm glad you were able to compact this into a few minutes for us. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
You could feel a sense of momentum on Tuesday night. The Trump administration is on a roll. At one point, the president was almost taunting Democrats because legislatively, there is very little they can do to stop him right now. Republicans in Congress certainly won't.
So Democrats sitting before me, for just this one night, why not join us in celebrating so many incredible wins for America?
And yet, if there's one area where the political ice is particularly thin this winter, it's Americans' finances.
You don't know what you're going to wake up to tomorrow.
You notice how much a loaf of bread is?
I'm nervous for everybody and what's going to happen to the heating oil.
This week, as tariffs against Canada and Mexico took effect, nearly every item we import from our neighbors had a 25% tax slapped on it.
This country does not have the production or the labor to make up for what Canada is producing and shipping in.
That means American consumers, who have already been feeling the pinch for months, are now about to start paying even more for a lot of items. And it doesn't stop there, because in response, Canada started taxing American products. Our machines, our whiskey, liquor stores in Canada have started clearing their shelves of American labels.
Somehow, we've become one of the victims in this process. So,
Jeff Quint is a distiller in Iowa who relies on that income. His workers rely on him.
Our shipments are fairly small compared to some of the bigger players, but if everybody stops shipping bourbon out of the country and we can only make it here, it's going to put that downward pricing pressure on the whole industry.
But despite the obvious political risks here, President Trump told the nation that he was barreling forward with this plan. He told producers like Jeff to trust him.
There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that.
But then, as if to highlight the nerves jangling around the American economy right now, the White House announced some of these tariffs will not go into effect on schedule. Specifically, the first announcement was about tariffs on cars. For more on that, let's go to ABC's Elizabeth Schulze, who covers economics for us. Elizabeth, this seemed like a backtrack from the president, right? What's going on here?
Backtrack, maybe reprieve temporarily is the best word, Brad, to use when we're talking about what this means. This is a one-month exemption from those 25% tariffs for automakers.
At the request of the companies associated with USMCA, the president is giving them an exemption for 1 month so they are not at an economic disadvantage.
What's the USMCA? Well, that is the free trade deal that was really one of the crowning achievements of President Trump's first term that essentially meant that there is free trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And what the Trump administration came out and said was automakers that are complying with the rules of that agreement, they don't have to face these additional 25% tariffs, which are really steep for autos, and they're going to have a break for a month at least to not have to pay those higher import costs. The reason why that matters is because the auto sector really is an industry that was going to get hit especially hard by these tariffs. The supply chain when it comes to making a car is so closely linked between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. There are thousands, tens of thousands of different parts that basically cross over the border every day. I mean, it can be hard to even track how much of this is happening.
Oh, like you send us your body of the car, then we'll add the engine thing, but then you guys are going to do the painting or add this random part or this chip or something. It keeps going back and forth.
Exactly right. And part of the USMCA agreement had been to encourage those supply chains, that free trade, to happen, to incentivize automakers to actually move their production from farther away places like countries in Asia back closer to the United States. And that's what's happened in recent years. And that's why we have these really interconnected supply chains. So the automakers were really sounding the alarm about how intense of a price they'd have to pay with those 25% tariffs.
What prompted the change from the White House?
Well, we know that the big three automakers, Ford, Stellantis, and GM, spoke with President Trump as these tariffs were taking effect, essentially making the case about how big of an impact this would have on the industry. Ford's CEO, Jim Farley, has been really outspoken about this. At one point, he said the tariffs would blow a hole in the U.S. industry and give Asian and European manufacturers a very distinct competitive advantage.
All right, and I want to pause here to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the reaction from these car companies. That's after the break. Welcome back to Start Here Weekend from ABC News. I'm Brad Milkey. Before the break, ABC's Elizabeth Schulze was describing President Trump's pause on auto tariffs and how that pause came right after a meeting with American automakers.
Clearly, these car companies were making the case to the president that this would undermine their own competitiveness when it comes to U.S. auto manufacturing. And we had seen warnings that car prices for consumers, too, would dramatically go up. I mean, the average car price for a new car could have gone up $3,000, even higher than that for an SUV.
You could be talking 15%.
15% higher price that consumers, buyers pay.
Yes, across the board. Absolutely.
I talked to one car dealer who told me that they would have almost immediate price hikes on the showroom of his dealership.
It's an immediate impact because since COVID, we really don't have inventory. We only have a 30-day supply. So that gets, you know, evaporated very quickly as people come in and buy cars.
There had been a lot of concern, and there frankly is still concern about how those higher prices will affect not just the companies, but also consumers who are in the market for a new car, too.
What was the reaction in both the American economy and from foreign leaders? Because, again, it's not even like cars are one thing. Yes, they're delayed. Nothing else is, it sounds like.
Yeah, not surprisingly, you saw those automaker stocks rally after this exemption was issued. They had been especially hard hit, and the broader stock market did rally in response to the idea that maybe President Trump is more open to some exemptions on these across-the-board tariffs. At the same time, you still have the reality that this is just a one-month reprieve.
Does he expect them to be able to shift production within a month?
He told them that they should get on it, start investing, start moving, shift production here to the United States of America, where they will pay no tariff. That's the ultimate goal.
A month is nowhere near enough time for these automakers to make the kind of decisions that would change their production over the longer term.
Canadians are hurt. Canadians are angry.
Plus, you still have the top U.S. trading partners of the United States not exactly happy about these sweeping tariffs that are still in effect broadly beyond autos.
What he wants is to see a total collapse of the Canadian economy, because that'll make it easier to annex us, is the second half of his thought. Now, first of all, that's never going to happen. We will never be the 51st state.
You heard Prime Minister Justin Trudeau essentially say after he had this almost hour-long conversation with President Trump, well, we're talking still. President Trump said the conversation was somewhat friendly, not exactly encouraging when you're thinking about the relationship between the U.S. and one of its biggest trading partners. You still have Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum vowing to impose tariffs on Sunday. But there's still a lot of questions, Brad, about even if there are limited exemptions in place, this is a dramatic shift in trade policy, and there will still be impacts for households and for businesses as they're trying to figure out what this looks like, plus the threat of additional tariffs in just 1 month from the Trump administration that could be even more broad-based.
Right, and you can hear, like, Trudeau's voice. They are still fired up. Like, there's real anger there about how they've been spoken about. And so, like, what 1 month of auto pauses doesn't quite undo all that. All right. Elizabeth Schulze, really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, as always, Brad.
Speaking to Congress on Tuesday, President Trump did make a few unexpected announcements. Perhaps one of the most significant was that we now had custody of one of the men suspected to be behind the attack at Abbey Gate in Afghanistan. If you don't remember what I'm talking about, this was part of America's chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, the first year of the Biden presidency. We had announced we were leaving, the Taliban quickly took over Kabul, and as panicked Afghans tried to crowd into American cargo ships, a bomb blast went off at a choke point near the airport.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
That attack killed almost 200 people, including 13 American service members and more than 150 Afghan civilians. And now, nearly 4 years after that attack, President Trump announced that we'd caught one of the alleged perpetrators. By Wednesday, he was making his first appearance in a U.S. courtroom, and ABC's Alex Mallon was there. He covers the Justice Department. Alex, who is this guy?
Yeah, so, I mean, Brad, really what we know about him is remarkably little at this point. We know his name is Muhammad Sharif Allah. He goes by Jafar, according to court documents that were released by the Justice Department. And we know that he was interviewed on Sunday by the FBI, and we believe that was in Pakistan. Trump administration officials have been going out saying that the CIA alerted Pakistan to Sharif Allah and his role in the bombing at Abbey Gate. And what they found out after this interview is he admitted to actually having a role in several other major terror attacks. Wow. There was a 2016 bombing at the Canadian embassy in Kabul that was also related to ISIS-K. He also participated in that in a surveillance role, he admitted to the FBI. And he also told the FBI that he aided the ISIS-K terrorists who carried out that attack on the Moscow concert hall in March of last year. We know he admitted to the FBI that in that 2021 attack at Abbey Gate, he served essentially in a surveillance role as a spotter so that the suicide bomber could position himself among the crowd to inflict maximum damage.
Okay, so we got him in custody. He gets extradited to the U.S., like he's on American soil. What happened in court on Wednesday?
Yeah, so he appeared before a magistrate judge in Alexandria Federal Court in Virginia. He walked in. He was in a blue getup. He did not have his legs or hands shackled, which kind of surprised me. Typically, when you see terrorism suspects come into the U.S., into a federal court, they are shackled. He was surrounded by three very large U.S. marshals who stood at attention, watching him very intently the entire time. He had an interpreter. The judge essentially just read him his constitutional rights. He is now a criminal defendant in the U.S. justice system. He is afforded the same constitutional rights that any criminal defendant in the system is afforded. And he acknowledged through his interpreter to the charge that he now faces, aiding a terrorist group, which could, if he is convicted, land him in federal prison for the rest of his life, Brad.
And then at the end of the day, what does this tell us about, I guess, ISIS-K, where as it currently stands, and America's presence in that region? Because we've gotten so many people out of that region, and yet it does sound like we had enough assets to locate him there.
Yeah, I think that what we've heard from officials since this arrest was announced by the president at that joint address on Tuesday was that they see this as highlighting their relationship with the Pakistani government that precedes, you know, obviously what we saw was a frayed relationship after the killing of Osama bin Laden during the Obama administration. They see this as essentially showing the strength of the Trump administration and their ability to make deals that they believe previous administrations like the Biden administration would never have been able to make. Obviously, we heard from President Trump during his address touting his support for the Gold Star families that were killed in the Abbey Gate attack repeatedly across the time of the campaign trail, and using that essentially to attack President Biden over and over over the administration's handling in that disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021.
In Afghanistan, he humiliated our nation with the most appalling display of incompetence by an American president.
And Brad, you can't escape the timing of this. Obviously, this arrest being unsealed in a federal court just hours after President Trump announced it during his joint address to Congress. Remember, in those court papers, they say that Sharifullah was interviewed on Monday. It's unclear, and we still have put these questions to the administration. Why was he not immediately put on a plane then? Then we saw Tuesday those released photos showing FBI Director Kash Patel, Attorney General Pam Bondi, and other senior intelligence leaders on the plane to retrieve him. Again, you cannot escape the political messaging that really aligned with this very major terrorist arrest.
Right. And of course, this was treated very much like a political win for the White House, for the new FBI director, Kash Patel, for the new attorney general, Pam Bondi, who would prosecute all this. And of course, as sort of alliances are reevaluated here and we reevaluate how many people we have serving for us overseas, how all this kind of works together. All right. Alex Mallon, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
We'll start here on the other side of the break. Welcome back to Start Here Weekend from ABC News. I'm Brad Milkey. It's one of the most famous frauds in entertainment history. Would people really pay to try it again? You might have heard that the organizer of the infamous Fyre Festival, Billy McFarland, is out of prison. Back in 2017, he promoted this huge music festival on a private island.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations and is something that's hard to put in words.
Videos depicted white sand beaches, private jets, dance parties, and supermodels. Music stars had signed on.
We had this idea that what if we brought all forms of entertainment to one of these islands to make this new type of experience and festival.
Then ticket holders showed up and realized they had paid for nothing.
It's pretty much like hurricane relief tents with only two beds in each, so we can't be with any of our friends.
We had no electricity. We had nowhere to plug our phones. There was no showers. There was no beach view. Like, who goes to a beach with no beach view?
Instead of glamping villas, there were ramshackle tents. Instead of fine dining, there were cheese sandwiches. Organizers, it seemed, had collected money, but that hadn't been enough to deliver on their promises, so they fled. Well, not only is Billy McFarland back after pleading guilty and serving nearly 4 years for fraud, he says he's going to try this again.
Fyre 2 is real. My dream is finally becoming a reality.
Last month, McFarlane went on the Today Show to announce a new event, Fyre 2, the sequel to the festival that had never happened. And while he claimed this time would be different, this one will take place on a well-known island in Mexico called Isla Mujeres, there were, once again, some blank spots.
We are selling the experience of Fyre. I want to be one of the first festivals that can sell out with no artists.
But you do have them booked.
We're announcing the artists over the next few months, so I'm not in charge of booking the talent.
Keep in mind, tickets had already gone on sale, and they're even more expensive than the original. These ones start at $1,400, and packages including accommodations soar up past $25,000. For those who want to stay on a private yacht, there are packages available for $1.1 million. But here's the thing. Local officials on Isla Mujeres say this whole venture is news to them. In a statement to ABC News, the local tourism board there says, regarding Firefest 2, no person or company has requested permits from this office or any other municipal government offices for said event. Tourism Director Edgar Gasca told The Guardian, quote, for us, this is an event that does not exist, end quote. He pointed out, if you paste the GPS coordinates listed on this stylized Fyre 2 website, those coordinates actually lead you to a spot that's not even on the island. It's half a mile offshore. There are red flags all over the place, he said. Which makes you wonder, is all of this just a scam? An experiment to once again see if people will fork over their money to this guy. McFarland himself put out a video on social media addressing the mounting concerns.
First, Fyre 2 is real. Second, we have incredible partners leading the festival. They're in charge of all the logistics, productions, and operations.
He claimed the reason officials haven't heard from him is that third-party vendors have been handling logistics. One of these groups is called Unique Travel, which says they've established contact with the local government, though it wasn't clear whether they did that before selling tickets or whether they've obtained any of the approvals they'd need. McFarland also assured partygoers they would have hotels, despite some of the hotels listed on the website telling reporters they have not received official inquiries. McFarland blamed the hotels.
After hearing this, I asked my team to terminate those contracts and to focus on the hotels and other partners who are eager to work with and support Fyre.
Again, no details there. He just basically says, trust me, you'll have hotels. Trust me, we'll have artists.
Artists, athletes, and other performers are on board and scheduled for Fyre 2.
At this point, potential guests have to be aware this could be a disaster. And indeed, that could be what some people are paying for. For all of its inconveniences, chaos, and even health concerns, the 2017 debacle spawned viral memes, multiple documentaries, and federal court cases. Its attendees were part of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And more than entertainment, that is what modern party planners are promoting.
Fyre 2 is moving forward, and we are moving forward with full integrity.
One thing is certain, though. McFarland can certainly use the money. He still owes $26 million in restitution from the last time his promises went up in flames. And one last thing. You wouldn't think it would take much to sink a ship, but this will take months. For the last 30 years, this legendary ship has sat in the Delaware River between the banks of New Jersey and South Philadelphia. Her name is the SS United States.
Christened the SS United States. She was 5 city blocks long and grossed over 53,000 tons.
With its hulking black hull and its huge smokestacks, this ship looks a bit like the Titanic, only bigger. Constructed in the 1950s, it was 1,000 feet long and was built to be the world's fastest ocean liner, which it was. It set a transatlantic record that still stands for a ship of its style.
She carried 4 U.S. presidents, over 1 million passengers, diplomats.
This is Warren Jones, who's on the board of directors for the SS United States Conservancy, the group that protects this ship's legacy.
She really was an ambassador to the world. For the United States.
And he says the ship was so colossal that it ended up serving dual purposes. It was used to carry America's well-heeled clientele and sometimes its troops.
American servicemen and servicewomen traveled on her to Europe and back. I was lucky to be aboard her in 1961, just a wee lad of 8 years old, and crossed to Europe, and a year later came back on the SS United States, and it was an unforgettable experience.
Over the years, though, she's grown rusty, faded. Landlords didn't know what to do with her. Well, this week, she completed one of her final voyages.
The SS United States is approaching the next phase of the long journey to its final resting place.
The SS US traveled from Philly, around Florida, and up the Gulf Coast, where she will be sunk and laid to rest just off of Okaloosa County, Florida, to become the largest artificial reef in the world. This has become a common thing in recent years. Reefs can protect harbors, they can provide a home for diverse marine wildlife, and barnacles and oysters aren't really picky about what they will grow on. Other ships have been turned into reefs, so have decommissioned oil rigs and New York City subway cars. Okaloosa County alone has more than 500 artificial reefs, and tourism officials hope this massive one will soon become home to its own scuba scene.
It's kind of like a renaissance. It's a new time for her, and we will certainly embrace her as part of our artificial reef network.
Which I would think, okay, cool, you get the ship there, you sink her, game over. But it's not that simple. Wednesday morning, she arrived in Mobile, Alabama, right next door, where she will be prepped for sinking.
There's actually 120 fuel tanks on board that have varying levels of fuel still left in them. So all of that has to be removed and disposed of in an environmentally friendly way.
The ship didn't look like much on her final voyage down the coastline. Salt air has taken its toll. The United States can't even steer herself any longer. She had to be towed. But even according to the tugboat captain, she still got speed.
The ship's handled better than anybody expected. The tugs, we've been towing the ship faster than we expected. I feel like we're a pallbearer to a superhero, to America's flagship.
There's something about ships like this that still inspire awe, reverence. In fact, as the ship left its berth in Philadelphia, people gathered to wave from the shores.
I feel like we're a pallbearer to a superhero, to America's flagship.
A lot has changed for this ship since her maiden voyage in 1952. A lot has changed for the country. But it's nice to know that we're all part of something bigger than any of us. Even as the tides churn and the waves crash, the SS United States will remain providing safe harbor long after we're gone. Okay, that will do it for us on what is technically our first week blasting out nationwide on Start Here Weekend. If you heard us on the radio the last couple weeks, consider that a sneak peek. You were the guinea pigs, but we're here now every weekend from now on. Start Here Weekend is produced by Mara Milwaukee, Aaron Ferrer, Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Amira Williams, Vika Aronson, and Anthony Ali. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of ABC's podcast programming. I'm our managing editor. Laura Mayer is our executive producer. Thanks to John Newman, Tara Gimble, and Liz Alessi. If you want to hear the daily edition of Start Here, check us out. Check out the podcast. We are up every weekday morning on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Just hit that follow button and you will get the latest episode magically beamed to your phone. You can find Start Here and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. And of course, check us out right here for another edition of Start Here Weekend. I'm Brad Milkey. I'll see you next week.